Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to talk with Matthew Wappett. He's Executive Director of the Institute for Disability Research, Policy, and Practice at Utah State University. We're going to talk about potential funding changes, which, if they pass, could result in funding cuts to University Centers for Excellence in Developmental Disabilities, or USEDs. These are congressionally authorized, federally mandated centers established under the Developmental Disabilities Act. There's at least one in every U.S. state and territory, and Institute for Disability Research, Policy, and Practice is Utah's designated center. Matthew Wappett says that the current proposal by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services to eliminate dedicated funding for USEDs and distribute that to the states as unrestricted block grants is a grave threat. He says while total funding might not disappear, there are no guarantees these funds would continue to support USEDs or even people with developmental disabilities at all. So Matthew Wappett joins us to talk about this. Thanks for coming in.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Tom.
So, tell us, first of all, what University Centers for Excellence in Developmental Disabilities are supposed to do.
Okay.
What are these?
Yeah. So, in the Developmental Disabilities Act, the most recent reauthorization of 2000, but way back in the early 70s, they passed the Developmental Disabilities Act, and it established three entities within each state to support the needs of families and people with developmental disabilities. There are developmental disabilities councils. There are protection and advocacy organizations, which would be like the Disability Law Center here in Utah. And then there are USEDs, University Centers for Excellence in Developmental Disabilities. Each of these organizations plays a unique role within the state. Developmental disabilities councils facilitate advocacy and really policy, getting families and people with disabilities involved in decisions about what goes on in programs. The Disability Law Center provides free legal support for people with disabilities, ensuring that civil rights are enforced, so discrimination, accessibility, things like that. And then University Centers for Excellence, we provide the training, research, and service aside of that. So each of these entities plays a unique role within the state, and we really probably have the larger role in that we're training professionals, we're training families, we're training people with disabilities, we're doing the research to gather evidence about what programs work and don't work, and then we're actually delivering services through many of our programs. So that could be anything from assistive technology, like our Utah Assistive Technology Project, to early intervention, to tutoring, to diagnostic services. Anyway, there's a whole gamut of things that we do within the state. And like you said, every state has a USED, like the Institute.
Yeah. So take us back, in history.
Yeah.
Before the Americans with Disabilities Act. Before the Developmental Disabilities Assistance and Bill of Rights Act.
Yeah.
I guess the onus was on families, I guess.
Good question.
Institutions.
Yes.
Is that where you'd put your family member in an institution?
You would. Okay. Yeah, you would. So there were some families who kept their children with disabilities home, but the vast majority were actually institutionalized in large institutions. I teach a whole class on this, on the history of disability, and people are shocked to recognize that going back to the 1600s, we started to lock away people with disabilities from our communities and from our societies and families, right? When they had a child with a disability, the doctors would say, oh, this child needs to be institutionalized. And so you didn't see people with disabilities in the community. You didn't see them in your schools, workplaces, things like that. They were literally locked up in these institutions that, for all intents and purposes, were like jails. They were understaffed. They were dirty. In some of these institutions, 75% of the folks in there had hepatitis or tuberculosis, just tremendous communicable disease. And the lifespan of people with disabilities living in these institutions was about 36 years. Mm. So they were not great places. And it was in the 1970s, families, advocates started to organize around the rights of people with disabilities and said, you know what, we can do better. A big part of that was President John F. Kennedy. And JFK had a sister, Rosemary Kennedy, who had a developmental disability. And his family had lived this experience of having Rosemary in an institution and then taking her out and having her live at home, and recognize that, you know, we just didn't have the community supports, the professionals, the programs to help people with disabilities live within the community. And so really, President Kennedy, before his death, had really mobilized a national group of experts to sort of kick off this planning. And he convened a council, the President's Council on Mental Retardation, and they produced a report. And in that report, they recommended setting up a system, the DD network, like I just mentioned, having these entities within each state to help support the needs of people with disabilities so they could live within our communities. So that's a quick Cliff Notes version of the history there.
Yeah, I appreciate that. So life expectancy in the 30s, right?
Yep.
That's increased now to in the 70s?
Oh, yeah. We're about 74, 75 years old. So, I mean, literally just moving where people with disabilities were, having them involved in our society and communities has extended lifespan. Yes, there have been medical, you know, advancements and things like that. But when you look at the data, you know, the big thing is people are living in healthier, more supportive environments, which has an impact on their overall health and longevity.
So that's focusing on those people with disabilities, right?
Mm-hmm.
What has this done, do you think, for society as a whole to bring those folks, you know, with us?
Yeah, I think it makes us better people. having a whole segment of society that doesn't exist there creates expectations that, oh, these people don't belong. These people are not part of our families. They're not part of our workplaces. And so, again, having people who are different, who have disabilities in the community, in our homes, in our schools, really helps us create more realistic expectations about, right, how do we support people who maybe have needs that are different than ours? And the interesting thing about disability is that, you know, yes, you could lock away people with disabilities, but the fact is that disability is the most common aspect of diversity within. It's the largest, if you were to look at it from a minority group perspective, people with disabilities are the largest minority group in the United States. Approximately 25% of the U.S. population has a disability of some sort. And we will all experience disability in some way, shape, or form, whether that's a family member, whether we acquire it through illness, accident, aging. Disability, you know, outside of birth and death, is the most common aspect of being human. And so having those people in the community and understanding, oh, this is just part of being human. This is how I support somebody, right, whose needs are different, who maybe does things differently than me, actually creates a more compassionate, aware, and supportive society.
Mm. You say all of us will be touched, personally, you know, if by nothing else, by aging.
Yep.
But 25% of families, right, are touched by this.
Yep.
At any given point,
right now. Yep, right now. Yep.
Yeah.
It's a huge proportion, and people don't recognize it. People also don't recognize what qualifies as a disability. You know, so if you look at the Americans with Disabilities Act, disability is anything from, right, being diagnosed with depression, having a mental health issue, you know, to, you know, potential loss of a limb, paralysis, maybe some of the more visible things we think of. And so it's a very broad spectrum of conditions. They sort of fall under this umbrella of disability.
So Americans with Disabilities Act, the Developmental Disability Assistance and Bill of Rights Act, we've been talking about, established kind of this framework. And you pointed out that it's been the federal government taking the lead.
Yep.
Tell us about this proposal from the Department of Health and Human Services, I guess, which at least the way you see it would kind of see the federal government stepping back from a lead role.
Yeah. It's I'm going to go back and address something about the importance of the federal government's role in disability services. And again, going back to history, when we look at, right, institutions, things before the 1970s, States, local communities never had the resources to really provide the support necessary to meet the needs of people with disabilities. And so from even the colonial era, the federal government played an important role in providing funding and support for these institutions for disability services. And that's not just the case here in the United States. That's the case in European countries and a lot of other countries, just because sometimes the needs of people with disabilities can be expensive, and it requires somebody with more resources to kind of step in and do that. And so so the federal government stepping away from this, saying we're not interested in doing the research on what programs work, we're not interested in continuing to train professionals to work with people with disabilities, it leaves a huge gap, because there's really not the resources within a state or a local community to fill that. And again, it's not like disabilities going away. In fact, the prevalence of disability, if you look at it, because we have better diagnoses, better treatments, everything else, it's actually increasing. We have more people living with disabilities today than we did 20 years ago, just because we're getting better at supporting people with unique needs. And so by the federal government stepping back, it leaves a huge gap in terms of understanding, what programs work. How do we diagnose conditions? How do we accurately support a family who has a child with autism, A lot of those things would go away. There just wouldn't be the capacity to do that. We are the only research entity here within the state of Utah who is focused on disability issues. And so there's really not another entity who's going to step in and do this work. So again, and that's true in every state that has a USED. There's really just not a backup, because USEDs have been seen as sort of the primary first line of defense isn't the right word, but first line of intervention. Let's call it that.
Yeah. So the proposal is to stop dedicated funding to USEDs and instead give that same amount of money in a block grant to states?
It's really hard to know exactly what it is. When we look at the proposal that's currently on the books, yes, it looks like it lumps together a whole bunch of disability-related funding. It block grants it to states, and then states have the discretion to do with it as they see fit. Which would mean, and among these programs, it's not just USEDs. This would be things like traumatic brain injury service centers. This would be service centers for people with paralysis. There's a whole bunch of other disability programs.
Limb loss is lumped in, yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, and they all get lumped together. It gets sent to the state, and then the state can decide what to do with it. And the state may decide to put it towards disability. The state may decide to use it for something else. I mean, it's primarily the same issue that advocates have had with block granting in general. You know, there have been lots of block granting proposals from the federal government around Medicaid and other things. And, you know, that notion that you're going to give money to the states and they're going to use it in a way that's going to meet the needs of these populations is not a guarantee. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so it is a concern that, you know, that and the money could disappear altogether, really. We just don't know. But the hard part has been, you know, through history, disability funding for the Developmental Disabilities Network for USEDs has always been a bipartisan issue. We've never faced a point where somebody said, oh, we don't like disability. We're not going to support disability. So it's sort of a new game for a lot of disability advocates who haven't had to deal with that, because in the past we've had folks who've recognized that it's important that we have these programs.
Has the administration said anything about this, why they're moving in this way?
So these disability programs have been lumped in with DEI. And I think anybody who's been paying attention to the news knows that the current administration has been targeting DEI practices. And at the very beginning, actually within the first 2 days of the presidency, they put out an anti-DEI executive order. And that DEI executive order included another letter, A, So DEIA, diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility. So from the very beginning, disability was lumped in with other DEI policies. And to a certain extent, I understand why. Many disability laws, right, the ADA, Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, are civil rights laws. They are protecting the rights of people with disabilities, very much like other civil rights laws. But it has made disability an issue that is partisan, whereas in the past, it hasn't been. Going back to your original question, it's really being lumped together with DEI, which is an interesting way of looking at a universal human phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
So I get, you know, I'm on a futile quest here to put words in Trump administration officials' mouths, but so we want less accessibility, right? We want fewer services for the disabled? I don't know.
That seems to be the direction things are going. You know, the big, beautiful bill that was passed, just a few weeks ago, right, cuts Medicaid and ensures that, right, there's not going to be the same amount of Medicaid supports for people with disabilities. There's a huge lobby of businesses that feel like accessibility mandates are expensive and they don't want to make their businesses accessible. They don't want ramps. They don't want, you know, they don't want to have a digitally accessible website because they're like, oh, that's too onerous, right? You're forcing us to do something that we don't want to do. And so there is an element of society that thinks that these civil rights laws around the rights of people with disabilities are not something that they want to comply with. And so there is that out there. When we look at the research, when we look at what happens, we find that businesses that are more accessible, businesses that are catering to, right, the needs of everybody in their community, not just the able-bodied, tend to be more successful. They tend to generate more revenue. They tend to be viewed more positively. You know, putting in a ramp to your business is not just going to help somebody in a wheelchair. It's going to help a mother who uses a stroller. It's going to help an older person who uses a cane or a walker, right, get in. And so a lot of times, you know, these accessibility mandates, although they're under the guise of, right, being more accessible to disabilities, actually benefit everyone within society. So anyway, I could ramble on about that for a long time.
Yeah, no, that's an important topic. Yep. Let's take a brief break. We'll come back and talk much more about this. We're talking with Matthew Wappet, Executive Director of the Institute for Disability Research, Policy and Practice at Utah State University. More follows this. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Matthew Wappet. He's Executive Director of the Institute for Disability Research, Policy, and Practice at Utah State University. And we're talking about University Centers for Excellence in Developmental Disabilities. These are congressionally authorized, federally mandated centers established in every U.S. state and territory. And this potentially is coming under threat. Matthew Wappet says the current proposal by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services in the budget would be to eliminate dedicated funding for these centers, which the Institute for Disability Research, Policy, and Practice is the Utah Center, and redistributed states as unrestricted block grants. So Matthew Wappet, I guess maybe reinforce for us again, what do you think, I guess, the potential to happen? It gets converted to a block grant. I guess then the state of Utah could do whatever, right?
Yeah. They could use it for whatever they want. It becomes a sort of an unrestricted pool of federal money that may go to disability, may not.
Right. The other thing that we've been talking about as well is federal government is always taking the lead on this.
Yep.
If they step back, what do you think would happen?
I think states would have to reevaluate where they're investing. One of the reasons that the federal government stepped into the disability realm, especially going back to the 70s and 80s, was that states weren't doing that. There was horrific abuse, neglect in states where the federal government hadn't been providing support. And so a lot of the disability policies that were passed in the 80s, 90s, so the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act and the ADA and others, sets up incentives. So the federal government says, we'll pay this much if you kick in this much, as a way to sort of ensure that states have skin in the game, but also, again, to incentivize state sort of compliance with some of these disability policies. And I think a great example was the state of New Mexico. The state of New Mexico was actually the last state in the union to offer special education. And they didn't offer special education until the federal government said, yeah, you're not going to get any money from us unless you comply with this and educate children with disabilities in your state. And so it's always been this partnership. The federal government doesn't fund 100%, but they do fund a vast proportion. You know, here in Utah, the federal government is probably funding about 70% they provide 70% of the funding for disability services covered under Medicaid and other programs.
So you mentioned some of your materials that your institute takes federal money and then amplifies it.
Yeah. Yep. So that's the one thing that and this is where it gets a little confusing for folks. Although we're a federally designated entity, we don't get a lot of federal money. So the money that's currently at risk is money that's called our CORE grant, and it's about $650,000 every year. And that $650,000 is money that comes to us, and our job, and this is actually written in the Developmental Disabilities Act, is to take that funding and to leverage it to bring in additional funding. It's essentially a grant to help us develop programs and write other grants, which is weird because typically on a grant or a contract, right, you can't work on negotiating another grant and contract. You're dedicated to doing that work. So the CORE grant gives us a little more flexibility, allows us to buy people's time to actually develop new programs and to pursue other grant opportunities. And so that $650,000, every year we have to report to the federal government, what did we do with that, right? It's kind of like the parable of the talents, right? Here, I'm going to give you one talent. Let's see how much you can make of this. Or there's the son that got the 5 talents or the 10 talents, right? And the father wanted to see how much they would make of it. I mean, it's a very similar model. Every year our main metric is leveraging, right? How many additional programs were we able to bring in? So a great example, this last year was actually one of our biggest years. Out of that $650,000, we brought in $33 million to Utah State University and the state of Utah for various related programs. We had 274 different projects running through the institute, from early intervention to special education to adult disability services to aging, Alzheimer's, veterans. I mean, it really spans the gamut. And so, again, the threat, if this funding goes away, we then do not have the resources to create new programs and to leverage additional funding. It's really kind of – it's called the CORE grant for a reason. It's kind of core to the operations of what we do at the institute. And, you know, having talked about this quite a bit over the last couple of months, I recognize that's a little hard for people to wrap their head around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This whole concept, ADA, right?
Yeah.
Developmental Disabilities Act. These are bipartisan.
Yeah.
And you were reminding me before we went on the air, our own Senator Hatch.
Yep.
Reached across the aisle with Senator Ted Kennedy.
Yep.
And that Odd Fellows partnership that they established, which would probably never happen today, to establish some of these things. This is continued to be bipartisan.
Yeah, absolutely. From the very beginning, it was bipartisan because, you know, whether you're Republican, Democrat, Independent, whatever, disability touches your life, right? It's not a partisan issue. And so, yeah, Senator Hatch was actually one of the leaders. He was one of the co-sponsors of the Americans with Disabilities Act. In fact, the ADA would not have passed without his efforts to reach across the aisle and to get, the Democrats on board with that. He played a huge leadership role. And a lot of that work in developing the ADA actually happened here in Utah with the Institute. The Institute was established in 1972, and from the very beginning, Senator Hatch was involved with a lot of the work here at the Institute, and the Institute has continued to provide information and guidance to policymakers to help ensure that we are developing more effective policies and programs.
Yeah. So fast forward to today, this particular funding is under threat. I guess the proponents would say it's not under threat. We're just gonna send this money to block grant to the, to the states, right?
Yep.
But your view is it's under threat. What would you like people to do if they agree with you?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, the most important thing to do is to reach out to our senators and elected officials and let them know that the work that the Institute does, the work that disability programs in general do, is important, and that the funding for those programs should be maintained. We actually have a page on our website, idrpp.usu.edu, dedicated to this, where there's templates for letters and other things that people can download, and they can send them into elected officials and really help educate them. The decision making now is within the Senate and the House. And particularly the House right now is developing their federal budget proposal. And so although the proposed elimination is in the president's budget, right, the ultimate decision is made in the Senate and the House, and when they come to some agreement on what a federal budget looks like. And so the decision making now is in the hands of our elected officials. So if folks want to get involved, you can go to our website, download templates. You can go to our national organization, AUCD, Association of University Centers on Disability.org. And they have templates and ways to reach out there. But it is important. People underestimate what university centers do, because we're oftentimes in the background working behind the scenes. And yet, when we look here in the state of Utah, we run the Utah Assistive Technology Project. The Utah Assistive Technology Project provides free, low-cost assistive technology to people with disabilities who need it. These are folks who need wheelchairs, walkers, canes. We even do some work with prosthetics, computers, right? Like speech generators on computers for somebody who's maybe nonverbal. If these university centers go away, that service goes away. And all of a sudden, it's a lot harder to get a wheelchair and to get some of these low-cost, and in some cases, free assistive technologies out into our communities. And so, again, if people feel strongly about it, I would please advocate. We do feel that we do bring value here in the state.
All right. I wanted to talk a little bit about what you do and what families can do, and then get into some of the research. That's part of what you do, right? So I'm imagining some of our listeners will be, longtime, quote-unquote, members of this community, right? They have a family member, long time, and long since they've educated themselves and become part of networks and all the help that's out there. Still a big burden, right?
But
and hard in many cases. Maybe rewarding as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But maybe I'll have you speak to people who have a family member newly diagnosed or a new disability or just embarking on this journey and feeling overwhelmed, and where do I even find the information, and what do I do, and I need financial help, and all the rest of it. How best to get connected?
Yeah, that's actually a great question, and it is one of the largest challenges that families face. No family, let's think of a young couple. No young couple thinks, oh, my first child's going to have autism or something like that. And in fact, we hear people all the time say, oh, that's my worst nightmare. Right, is to have a child who has a disability, because it does change the nature of your life. Acquiring a disability, right? You get in an accident and you become paralyzed or you lose a limb, changes the way you live your life. And it does require a whole different skill set to figure out how to navigate these disability systems. There are disability systems in every single state, the state of Utah here too. But again, going back to the federal government's role, most of these disability support programs are government programs, whether that's Medicaid, which provides like health insurance, or vocational rehabilitation, which provides job placement and training, or whether it's special education, right, which is administered through the Utah State Department of Education, but it's a federal program, early intervention. And so, right, these government programs touch the lives of families and individuals with disabilities through every era, and it's hard to navigate these programs. And so that's one of the reasons that the USEDS is here, the Institute for Disability Research, Policy, and Practice. We have a role to help people navigate some of these systems. And so a lot of times people will reach out and say, how do I get connected? How do I get into Medicaid? How do I get enrolled in this program? How do I advocate more effectively for my young child with a disability in the school system? There are other resources here in the state too, many of which also receive federal funding. So like I mentioned, the Developmental Disabilities Council is a big one. The Disability Law Center, if you feel like you're being discriminated against, the Disability Law Center is a great resource to go to, and they can sort of evaluate your case and see if there's a legal intervention there. Another big one is the Utah Parent Center, which receives federal funding. It's called the Parent Training Institute. It's funding that comes through the Department of Education. And their job is to really help parents learn how to navigate these various systems that are going to touch the lives of their children with disabilities. I would say that's one of the biggest things that people struggle with is just, you know, you're diagnosed with a disability, you have a child with a disability, and all of a sudden you're like, oh, this is a whole new world. I've never had to deal with this many different programs. And yet in order to get the services and supports that you're entitled to, you have to learn how to play the game, for lack of a better term, and navigating them can be incredibly challenging.
You just acquired a part-time job, or in some cases another full-time job, right? Yeah, to navigate all this.
Yep. Well, and there are dedicated navigators. I mean, There are folks at the state, care case managers and care coordinators, and, you know, there are folks whose job is to help you with that, but you've got to get connected with them first. And
So how to connect with Institute for Disability Research, Policy, and Practice?
So you can connect with us through our website, like I said, idrpp.usu.edu. Folks can email me. I'm the director, and I kind of know everybody, and I can connect you with the right folks. My email's wappett@usu.edu, and we're happy to help in any way that we can. If we don't know the answer, we know somebody who does.
Yeah, very helpful. Let's take another break. We'll come back. I want to talk a little bit about research and a couple other things. So we're talking with Matthew Wappett, Executive Director of the Institute for Disability Research, Policy, and Practice at Utah State University. More following this. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. I'm talking with Matthew Wappett, Executive Director of the Institute for Disability Research, Policy, and Practice at Utah State University. Let's get into talking about the research part of this. Tell me about some of the research happening.
Oh, I'm going to have to really think about that, because last year we did 86 different research studies. And so there's a lot to talk about there. I think some of the most exciting research that's going on right now are some of the collaborations that we have within the College of Education. We have a few researchers who are working with the Alzheimer's and Dementia Research Center, which was established here at USU a couple of years ago, really looking at that overlap between Alzheimer's, dementia, disability. And a big part of our research in that realm has been around supporting caregivers. A lot of times, the focus is on disability, and disability doesn't just focus the individual who has the disability. It really impacts the caregivers and the folks who provide that day-to-day support for somebody who maybe is losing ability or developing challenging behaviors. And so that's been some really exciting research within the College of Education. Another great one is at our Center for Mental Health Promotion, working with the Acceptance and Commitment Therapy Group in the Department of Psychology, trying to adapt some of those therapeutic tools to be used for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Most people don't know that people with developmental disabilities have a much higher prevalence of mental health issues than the typical population. The typical population, about 20% of folks, have a mental health condition like depression or anxiety. Among the population of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, that number is around 50 to 60%. And yet there's very few evidence-based interventions or materials to help address the mental health needs of this population. And so Ty Aller and some of his group is working with the acceptance and commitment therapy folks in the Department of Psychology to adapt these tools to help people with autism and with intellectual disabilities get the mental health support that they need. And again, you're going to notice a theme here. A lot of this, we're not doing basic research. We're not sitting at a bench looking at genetics and things like that. All of our research is very applied, right? How do we improve the services, supports, and programs for people with disabilities and make their quality of life better? Another big area of research that we've been focused on, this is out of our Center for Employment and Inclusion in Salt Lake, is employment practices for people with disabilities. People with disabilities have the highest unemployment rate of any group in the United States. If you look at intellectual and developmental disabilities, approximately 70% are unemployed. That's not because they don't want to work. It's because of a lack of creativity within our workplaces. We want somebody who can come in and sort of fill a gap. And sometimes people with disabilities require accommodations and changes to how a job looks. And so a lot of our research is looking at, right, how do we support employers? And how do we support people so that they can fit in better in the workplace and maintain successful, gainful employment in their community? So anyway, those are a few. There's a lot going on there. We're also doing stuff around early intervention, behavioral interventions for young children within childcare settings, a broad range. We're involved with the U of U Medical School on a study now looking at environmental impacts on child health. So looking at how things like pollution, right, the inversions that we get here in the wintertime and how that affects the long-term development of children. And does it result in the development of disabling conditions in the long run?
So, right.
Yeah.
Let's have about 5 minutes or so here. I want to talk about the training aspect, right? You train a lot of folks. What would you say to someone, a student, wanting to get into this field?
I would say, and it's not a field that you go into, because disability is something that touches every field. If you're going to work, let's say you're going to the business school here and you're going to go into human resources, a big part of your job is going to be helping find accommodations for a person with a disability in that workplace. Let's say you're going to be an engineer. Right? Engineers, if you're going to be, let's say, a civil engineer and build things, right? You're going to have to build things to ADA standards. And so you're going to have to understand, what does accessibility mean? How do I make this building, this bridge, whatever, right, accessible for a person with a disability? So it's not like it's a dedicated field that you go into. Disability really touches every field because it is a universal human phenomenon. And so really, a few years ago, back in 2020, we started a disability studies minor here at USU. And that disability studies minor has a couple of core classes, but it draws from classes in almost every major on campus. And so it's an easy minor to get because a lot of students are taking these. And the intent was to really show how disability intersects with all of these other professional career tracks, and helping to give students, I think, some of the tools and the perspective that they need to understand, right, how do I think about disability when I go out and I'm a teacher, or I'm like an HR professional, or like I said, an engineer, an architect, a doctor, a lawyer, right? All of those things, disability intersects with all of those areas. So anyway, that's a roundabout way to answer your question.
Yeah. What if you're an incoming student who has a disability?
Yeah.
I'm sure there's services.
There are. Yeah. So, and this is where it gets interesting. And again, this is a federal thing. In high school, in elementary and high school, you are entitled to special education and to accommodations. You are also entitled to them in higher ed, but there are less. And in higher ed, they're not required to identify you. You're required to self-disclose. And so if you're coming to USU or another university and you have a disability, it's important that you reach out to your Disability Resource Center and let them know, this is my disability, these are my needs, and they have dedicated personnel in those offices to help set up accommodations and supports for you so you can be successful within college. It does put a lot of the responsibility on you as the individual student. And yet students who do reach out and work with those offices can be incredibly successful in the university.
Just 2 or 3 minutes left. Well, let's return to where we began. University Centers for Excellence in Developmental Disabilities are federally mandated centers established under the Developmental Disabilities Act. There's at least one in every U.S. state, and IDRPP is Utah's designated center. So, Matthew, the current proposal by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services in the budget, which Congress will be looking at, seeks to eliminate dedicated funding for these centers, redistributed to states as unrestricted block grants. You say that's a grave threat. So I'll give you a couple minutes here. What would you have people do?
Yeah. Again, going back to what we talked about earlier, if you have been touched by any of the programs that we offer through the Institute, that could be early intervention, our Up to Three program, our Southeast Early Intervention program, our Assistive Technology program, it's an opportunity to advocate and to have your voice heard. And so if you go to our website, idrpp.usu.edu, we have a policy page, and that policy page outlines what the current issue is, and it provides some resources on how to reach out to elected officials and to let them know the work that USEDS do here in Utah and nationwide is important and makes a difference in the lives of people with disabilities and their families.
All right. And again, how can people contact you or the Institute?
Again, you can go to our website, idrpp.usu.edu. We have a contact form there, or you can reach out to me. My email is WAPPETT, WAPPETT, at usu.edu, and I'm happy to answer any questions or concerns folks might have.
We've been talking to Access Utah with Matthew WAPPETT, Executive Director of the Institute for Disability Research, Policy, and Practice at Utah State University. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Tom.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.
It's One Sky, Many Cultures. Skywatcher Leo T here. I hope you had the opportunity to see Venus and Jupiter shine in conjunction. You still can. They're very close in the east during early dawn Tuesday morning, the 12th. That's the closest they got, just really close. They're still up, though, low in the dawn in the east-northeast. And leading up to this, nights before, just a couple of nights, I saw two planets in the mountain campground early Monday morning, and they surprised me. Because they were kind of low, I thought they might be aircraft because they were so big, or UFOs, but they didn't appear to be moving. Turns out it was Venus and Jupiter. They're still close and fun to watch for a few days. That's Jupiter on the top. Always lots to look up in the skies as we do our rain dance to quench the earth and put out these fires and throw a little good energy to astronaut James Lovell, who died August 7th at 97, naval aviator, test pilot, mechanical engineer, and astronaut. In 1968, as command pilot of Apollo 8, he, along with Frank Borman, the commander of the flight, and William Anders, became the first three astronauts to fly to and orbit the moon. He then commanded the Apollo 13, famously, that mission to the moon in 1970. His first flight into space was with Frank Borman, launched aboard Gemini 7 in December of 1965. Gemini 6 with astronauts Wally Schirra and Tom Stafford aboard were scheduled to launch before, but problems kept them from launching until after Gemini 7. However, when they did, the two Gemini capsules maneuvered and eventually rendezvoused, a major development in traveling to the moon and how to make some space stations work. Then almost a year later, Lovell and Buzz Aldrin lifted off aboard Gemini 12 spacecraft atop a Titan II rocket on November 11, 1966. This trip complemented another difficult rendezvous and successful spacewalk, or EVA, extravehicular activity, that is. See a photo of the docked spacecraft orbiting south of Japan in range of the tracking ship Coastal Sentry Quebec and many others on the Skywatcher Facebook page. Next was Apollo, with three astronauts on board, and after the loss of Apollo 1 due to capsule fire and the death of three astronauts, a few months to stop and re-examine mistakes, make improvements, and perhaps grieve, the momentum started up again with flights in Earth's orbit to test the new Saturn V rockets and the new command module and the moon lander, which was still in development, by the way. By the time Apollo 8 came along, scheduled to test more hardware in Earth's orbit, but the USSR looked like they might take the lead and launch to the moon first, so NASA and the astronauts took a great risk and decided to go all the way to the moon. They did, and they went into orbit. A huge jump that much of humanity celebrated. On Christmas Eve, December 24, 1968, the crew read from Genesis as they orbited the moon with live television feed of the golden moon passing under and reading the peaceful message that celebrated the Earth, the moon, and creation. Most magical to this 9-year-old boy on that Christmas Eve when I got 2001 A Space Odyssey for Christmas from my aunt and uncle. And for millions of others around the world that were watching.
We are now approaching lunar sunrise, and for all the people back on Earth, the crew of Apollo 8 has a message that we would like to send to you. And from the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, a Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you.
This, of course, led to Apollo 11 and the first landing on the moon in 1969, and, of course, James Lovell in 1970 commanded the crew of the Apollo 13, which famously blew an oxygen tank 200,000 miles from Earth, and the crew and mission control and all of their contractors exerted wills of steel and intelligence to help bring back the crew after orbiting the moon to re-enter the Earth's atmosphere in the blue, warm oceans and life. Gene Kranz, one of the main flight controllers during the adventure, called it NASA's finest moment. Fast forward to now, and following their exploring footsteps, NASA's Artemis II Orion crew and spacecraft are moving closer to launch. See the NASA photo. The Orion spacecraft flying humanity's next crewed mission to the moon has completed propellant loading and is headed for the next phase of launch operations. This move marks a major milestone in preparing the spacecraft for the first crewed flight of NASA's Artemis II, which will send four astronauts on a 10-day mission around the moon and back next February if all goes well. So keep exploring, love your neighbor, look up, look around, and get just a little bit lost in space. Skywatcher Leo T.
It's the Beehive Archive on Utah Public Radio. I'm Megan Weiss. Motels dotted Utah's highways throughout the 20th century, beckoning motorists to pull off the road and spend their tourist dollars in rural towns. Now that hotel chains dominate accommodation options, what happened to these locally owned motels? Learn more after this.
I'm Jody Graham, Director of Utah Humanities. Beehive Archive is brought to you on Utah Public Radio by Utah Humanities, with the generous support of the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation. We are proud to partner with community organizations to tell Utah stories and hope you will tune in each week for the Beehive Archive.
Welcome to the Beehive Archive, a 2-minute look at some of the most pivotal and peculiar events in Utah's history. Paved roads and breathtaking scenery enticed thousands of tourists to southern Utah in the early 20th century. Small towns along the newly built roads embraced visitors. As one local newspaper wrote, quote, "Tourists who stay will keep the poverty away," unquote. The Arrowhead Trail was built during the 1910s and was the first all-weather road to connect Salt Lake City to Los Angeles. The route brought plenty of tourists to St. George, and local businessmen saw an opportunity to build comfortable lodgings to entice tired travelers to pull over and spend their money. The last of the original Arrowhead Trail was oiled and graveled in 1931, and the number of tourists stopping in St. George grew steadily. Dozens of motels and motor courts popped up with large parking lots. Using neon signs, comfortable accommodations, and postcard advertisements, motels drew tourists off the highway. Rural charm was a part of the appeal for tourists, and motel owners happily obliged. Swimming pools, ice makers, and friendly conversation could be expected at motels throughout southern Utah. Advertisements helped bring more tourists to local motels by praising the scenic beauty of southern Utah. A 1936 issue of National Geographic featured a full-color spread of Zion, Bryce, and Cedar Breaks, among other national parks and monuments. The article described the vivid colors and breathtaking scenery of Utah's rural lands, bolstering the golden age of road travel. After World War II, tourism skyrocketed, and in 1956, visitors to Zion National Park numbered over 400,000, nearly doubling from just a decade earlier. Like many other industries in Utah, local motels experienced their own boom and bust. At its peak, some 250 motels populated Utah's roads, most of them located in rural areas. Eventually, roads were improved and expanded to bypass small downtown communities. Today, the number of local hotels has dwindled to just around 100, with the great majority remaining in southern Utah. Although national parks continue to pull more tourists than ever, it is chain hotels and Airbnbs that now meet the demands of travelers. For many rural Utahns, tourism is a necessary industry, but one that has profoundly changed local business and natural resources. Find sources and past episodes of the Beehive Archive at utahhumanities.org. For the Beehive Archive, a production of Utah Humanities, I'm Megan Weiss.
You just heard a rebroadcast segment of the Beehive Archive, which is provided through a partnership with Utah Humanities. Due to the loss of National Endowment for the Humanities funding, Utah Humanities will cease production of the Beehive Archive. Utah Public Radio will continue to bring you rebroadcast segments of this program.